You're listening to Fusion Patrol, a listener-supported podcast. Each week, we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series, movie, or audio and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And tonight we are looking at the 8th episode of Season 3 of Bugs, Buried Treasure. Before I start the episode synopsis, I just want to say that I am having allergy problems, so I am hopped up on decongestants, antihistamines, cough suppressants, painkillers, and those lovely little lemon honey lozenges. So,
quite a cocktail.
Yeah, it is. It is. I am loaded. So, and I wrote this based while I was similarly loaded with medicine. So, here we go. The Bureau of Weapons Technology is brought in on a high-tech weapons case. A government art advisor, Mr. Delamere, appears to be skimming national art treasures off for his private collection. Before they get too deeply involved in that yawner of a case, they get called off for a real technology-related crime. Someone, calling themselves Athena, has arranged for two dangerous criminals to be released by hacking into the prison computer system. Roz catches her in the act of releasing another criminal, this time an explosives expert. They tail the prisoner as he is released from prison, and then, when they attempt to interrogate him incompetently, he escapes until Alex kills him in self-defense. Beckett will go undercover as the dead criminal with a high-tech microphone and camera on his person. Mr. Delamere, remember him? The case they dropped like a hot potato when the prison breakout started? Turns out he's being blackmailed by Athena. She wants half his plundered art treasures, or she'll take them all. Delamere refuses. Meanwhile, Ed has been AWOL to Alex's displeasure, and that's before she find out he's meeting with a beautiful ex-girlfriend for whom he's still got puppy dog eyes. This ex-girlfriend, Sasha, is now in the art world, and she's popped into Ed's life after 10 years because she wants something. She wants Ed and a helicopter to help with an art installation. Ed wags his tail, rolls over to have his tummy rubbed, and agrees to get the helicopter. That night, she takes Ed to the mansion of her benefactor and mentor, but we, the audience, recognize it as Delamere's house. While Ed marvels at the house's opulence, Sasha steps out to conduct a bit of business. Beckett, masquerading as James Flood, the explosives expert, receives a call from Athena, offering him a job. Alternatively, he can go back to jail. He accepts the job, and Roz traces the call. It comes from Delamere's house. Cue dramatic music. Roz and Alex go to Delamere's, but they trigger an alarm. When it goes off, Sasha tells Ed to run and ditches him on the spot. Confused, Ed is quickly captured by and subdued by Alex and Roz. They search the house and find Delamere dead. Beckett has now been collected by Athena, and she is Sasha. Watching over Beckett's camera, Ed agrees to go undercover also. He approaches Sasha and says he can still get the helicopter, but last night convinced him there's more than meets the eye to this so-called art installation. He wants a share and doesn't care if it isn't strictly legal. He is taken to their temporary HQ, where Beckett is building a bomb with a remote detonator, with Roz's remote help. There's also a little bit of blithering about Channing, jealousy, feelings, and other mushy stuff, but the signal gets cut out, and Roz doesn't hear his confession. Or so Beckett thinks. Delamere was storing his plundered art collection in an old disused government nuclear bunker built in the 50s or 60s. Athena has really done her homework, for one of her team of crack highly dangerous criminals happens to have had a lucrative career in designing and building government nuclear bunkers in the 50s and 60s before embarking on a life of crime. Beckett completes the bomb and they head out for the bunker. No longer needing her explosives expert, she sends Beckett back to the base for something, then blows him up using her own remote detonator, much to Ed's dismay. Flying to the bunker, Athena reveals she can fly a helicopter. But do the wheels turn in the little brains of Ed and the two remaining and soon-to-be unnecessary criminals? It does not appear to be so. At the bunker, they get in, find the art, and start to pack things up. Well, they start to pack up a small quantity of it, for there is far more there than can ever fit in that little helicopter. Ed tries to convince the electronics expert that Athena is going to kill them, just about the time they hear the gunshots as Athena kills the bunker expert. Before they can get the drop on her, she overhears and points a gun at them, offering the criminal 50-50 split to kill Ed. Ed escapes, but is locked in the bunker to die. But escape he does, just as Roz arrives. There's gunfire and the criminal is subdued, but Athena escapes in the helicopter, which has been shot up. It crashes, she dies in a fiery explosion, and all the artwork, miraculously, survives. Oh, and Beckett wasn't killed, he was just pining for the fjords. The end. Okay, buried treasure. Well, at least there was treasure, and it was buried under something.
Sort of.
Yeah, you know, dig a hole, put things in it, put a roof on it, that's kind of buried. So what did you think of this episode?
Well, helicopters, nuclear bunkers, not even a need to have a kind of weapons pretext for Bug's involvement. This was kind of much more up my street, I think. It felt certainly after the last couple of episodes, it felt more like a return to form.
I did want to scream at particularly Beckett, who does not seem to know when to shut up. You do not sit at a bunker or at a bench working on a bomb, talking to your handler over the microphone.
Yes.
Or when you're all in a little confined cot room, you and Ed are having a chin wag while the others are pretending to snore. You know, it was like, shut up, Beckett, just shut up, shut up, shut up. And worse, if you got to talk about the job. Not Roz, not Alex, not the girlfriend problems. Yeah, that one was getting on my nerves quite badly.
Well, I mean, obviously those conversations are in there to kind of move those plot strands forward, but I would be more inclined to lay the blame for that at the director's door, because I think it's partly about how those scenes are staged, that you could make it much more obvious that in either case they were only conversing when they were absolutely sure they wouldn't be overheard, or they're at least reasonably sure they wouldn't be overheard, whereas actually Becky was working on the transmitter in a fairly open space. So
a tent.
Even if you couldn't hear him, you could see that he was talking. And those beds were not in any way hidden whatsoever. So yeah, it was odd.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it was all right. It was an okay episode. I you know, once again, they literally flop it right in your face at the beginning. It's like, here, we've got this guy. We think he's stealing art. Why is that Beckett's wheelhouse? And how is it that if you know he's stealing the art, it's art. They're talking about Rembrandts, for crying out loud. How can they not know that he's stolen these things, or what he's stolen? How can they not have this asset tagged and inventoried? And I mean, it really stretched credibility at the beginning of that one. It's Bugs, but that one was beyond. He's a government art advisor. You know what you've given him to work with. You should know what's not there now. I don't know. It just, and you know, then it's nothing to do with the agency, and then a separate case brings them back in, and it turns out to be the same one.
Well, who'd have thought it?
Yeah.
I think, but in a way, because kind of return the return to form concept is for me, because so little of this was based in the bureau office. Jan was fairly peripheral to it. We had Alex in it, so it's clearly a series three episode, but it's always kind of painted with a very broad brush, and it makes up for that by having the explosions and having the stunts and having the sexy villainess, who I suspect may have been inspired by Xenia Onatopp from GoldenEye. At least that was what occurred to me during the Taekwondo tussle. So I kind of feel like, I don't know, watching Bugs and then complaining about credibility isn't really fair.
Okay. There is that. I won't deny that. But it is just kind of odd that they kind of just thrown it all up the, all right, whatever, we'll do. I think more to my complaint than and okay, it's directing. Maybe it's directing, you know, Ed and Beckett's talking seems stupid. But I have to say, there is a sequence where she kills Beckett, supposedly, because they don't need the explosives expert anymore.
Okay.
Not totally okay, but go on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not convinced that she doesn't need the explosives expert anymore, but, you know, she fine, sends him back, blows him up.
Okay, that's not actually my problem. My problem is, what is her logic in blowing up someone who she no longer has any need for? It's exactly the sort of thing that is going to make the other members of the team think, well, as soon as we're expendable, she's going to kill us too, which is obviously what Ed plays on. But I can't see what she gains by it. I can see what she loses by it, but I can't see what she gains by it, rather than just
not having to
stringing Flood, quote, Flood along, and then, you know, double-crossing him later.
No witnesses, no Confederates to give you away, don't have to split. I'm not saying it's a good plan. It's not a good plan. But the thing is that, you know, not only does she blow up the weapons expert before they use the explosives, which seems like you're being a little bit, perhaps, cart before the horse there. But when Ed is flying, which I think I almost mentioned this, maybe I did mention it last time. We haven't seen Ed fly a helicopter since the first episode, have we?
Right.
Yeah. So I was kind of like, I almost mentioned it last time. If I didn't mention it last time, and I was thinking, and then here it is, Ed in a helicopter. So they were listening and then went back in time and put the helicopter in. But when she says, oh, I've been taking helicopter lessons, that is the moment that Ed should have said, I see, I get the helicopter, it's in my name, I'm the one that gets blamed for it, and I'm dead. And they all get out of the helicopter, and Ed stays behind in the helicopter, and I would have been so much happier if Ed had sabotaged that helicopter, taken a spark plug out, disconnected something, anything, so that, you know, if Sasha does try to leave without him, maybe not killing him, but tries to leave without him, she's not going anywhere. And that would have convinced me that Ed was playing with a full deck in this episode. But, but he was not.
Well, yeah, although, again, you know, I think you've got to kind of allow for the fact that Ed is under her influence in this. Again, you know,
I can
the
see
idea
why.
Of an old flame turning up seems kind of vintage bugs. And I did think, you know, it was quite a good episode for Craig McLaughlin. He got to do some nice emoting. The scene where he tries to stop her from taking off in the helicopter, knowing that it's damaged, and then kind of is forced to watch as it spirals out of control. And actually, I will say that was nicely directed as well. So even though I think there were some scenes where the staging was ropey, that was done well.
Yeah, he did. He seemed upset. She was a weird character, Sasha, and they did a good job of that. I will say that. That bit where she tries to beat up Ed as foreplay or whatever it is, I didn't think of Anya Top, but I definitely thought she's nuts.
It's that she's nuts, but it's the excitement junkie. You need to know why, because I think this is what was a difficulty in early Bugs, and maybe why they had some trouble sustaining it and then went on to have a recurring villain, is that you need a new villain, a new kind of uniquely interesting villain with their own particular drive in each episode. I mean, having week after week a villain who just, you know, wants to enrich themselves or whatever is a bit boring. So having someone like Sasha, who is clearly a thrill seeker, who is looking for excitement, who's interest in what she's doing is probably just in pulling it off.
And that's why she wanted to kill her Confederates then. The thrill of it.
Well, she's, I mean, clearly not high on morality, but I didn't think that she was wanting to kill Ed. I think that she likes Ed, but that she was using the others. And, you know, she was doing it because she could. That was the kind of sense I got. So, I kind of... I quite liked that. I didn't necessarily get the logic of even why she had to kill people. I mean, my previous point was really the timing of it just didn't seem to make sense. But I don't know why she killed Delaware or whatever his name was.
Gordon John. Oh, Delamere. Yeah, I know why she
Delamere.
Killed
him. Murray Melvin, who will
Caravaggio
be...
from Star Hunter Redux.
Exactly. Star Hunter fans will have been very excited, although made me think of Torchwood, so that's all right.
No, it's not Bilbo Billis. Baggins. It's,
Yes.
Billis,
Billis. Billis Manger.
Manger, that's it. Yeah, I saw him and I immediately thought Torchwood dude. And then I'm like, wait a minute, he's in something else. Oh, yeah. Definitely was not first Star Hunter. I will, even though I have seen loads more of him in Star Hunter than I have in Torchwood. So if you're trying to stretch the logic of an episode of Bugs and you're going to forgive it, all its illogic, then there's not much left.
Well, that's
rude. I thought
rude,
this
but...
plan was a little... Well, first off, she's good enough to hack into the prisons. So does she really need an expert, electronics expert, whose job is to spend literally 30 seconds opening that electronic lock? That's all that guy did. Now, he's good, so if they could find somebody as good as Roz, you know, it wouldn't take long, but it just seems kind of like that was not a particularly overly complex seeming system for her to have to go to the effort of getting a guy out of prison. And then the other one, and I alluded to it.
Well, I don't think you can tell that. I think the problem is that these things conflate being an electronics expert with being a programmer or hacker. And that's understandable because they're never going to be able to go into these things in depth. But actually, to make it credible that she's one and not the other, you have to make that distinction. They didn't really bother.
And then I really want to know Gordon John. I want to know his history. Because there's this sort of implication that these guys are really bad criminals. They're in for a long time. So what is it that Gordon John did? He's a man who was an engineer designing and building nuclear bunkers for the government. That's probably a very high-paying job. B, quite a long time ago, because they specifically said they built them in the 50s and 60s.
Uh-huh.
And this was in the 90s. So that means this guy did that 30 years ago when he was about 15. Yeah. Didn't really look like that was very viable there, but okay. And he must have some story where he had that job and he was doing all that stuff and probably making a lot of money. And then somehow he ended up being a serious criminal and locked away. And his scheme is, oh yeah, I know how to turn on the elevator and I know what the door is made out of. Not really a whole lot of, imagine if she could hack into the blueprints department, she could find that out. Just at a guess. But one that doesn't bother me as much, but it should have bothered Ed, is when she takes him to Delamere's house. So this is my mentor, this is my whatever she called him, I forget, benefactor. And you walk into that ridiculously opulent house with all that ridiculously expensive artwork, you know, for a government consultant. And Ed
looks like the kind of house a Murray Melvin character would live in, though.
Well, fair enough. But Ed doesn't go, you couldn't just hire a helicopter? You need to get somebody to do you a favor to do this for free?
I had that problem when she asked him in the first place. It was like, I don't really see... Why
that too.
Someone who is this well connected needs him to do something that is kind of fairly run of the mill. If it had been to fly a helicopter doing some kind of exceptionally daring stunt that only someone of Ed's caliber could do,
yeah, okay.
But actually just organizing a helicopter, well, it seemed a bit unlikely.
Yeah, and could say it was a little bit dodgy when she brought the idea up in the first place. Well, when they go to that house, because she does mention, you know, it's for a starving artist and all this stuff. But then they followed up with, no, she's loaded. Or these people she hangs out with are loaded.
Yeah. And so lots of them would have helicopters.
There's probably one out in the back pad behind the house if they just looked, you know, in the garage. But yeah, it was a little, again, I know Ed is definitely enraptured by her. And, you know, again, why not? But alarm bells should have been going off repeatedly throughout the course of the episode. Let's see. Eventually, we're going to have to talk about Beckett and Roz and Alex and Ed. I'm going to put that off as long as I possibly can. Was this Alex's first kill?
I can't remember.
Now,
I seem to remember there being another similar multi-story car park incident.
Yeah.
But was it bugs or was it something else?
Well, I mean, we've had one of the discussions we had on I think at least two previous episodes, and I think it's the one where they were going to poison the water supply with the food that's allergic to ultraviolet light, and the one where Ed has to shoot somebody at their wedding. Shotgun Wedding, that one I remember the title for.
But which was the one where someone drove a car off the multi-story car park into the canal?
Crime Traveller,
that was it. Right, yeah, okay. The problem here being that 28 episodes into Bugs, some of the episodes are slightly blending together, and clearly not only that, but general kind of schlocky 90s Saturday evening sci-fi is similar enough that I'm getting two different shows confused together. But there was something of that scene in it. I tell you what else, actually, when we're thinking of kind of late 90s sci-fi, I think I spent a while trying to work out what it was, but I think that set where we first see Sasha doing the hacking with what looked to me at the time as angels on either side of her looked very much like a set that I think was in Doomwatch, Winter Angel.
It does.
If I remember that right, or I misremembered it from something else.
I think there is kind of a similarity there. We're talking about the guy with the stupid angel interface on his computer.
Yes, I thought he had statues on either side of the computer, and it was that same kind of, I don't know, it just had a really similar vibe to it. And it's not
generic,
I don't
big
think it,
room where you put the computer in the middle of the room on a desk.
Yes,
like everyone does.
I think that was the kind of 90s aesthetic of what computer hacking looks like. So I don't think there was any sense in which they were copying, or I mean, it was in Winter Angel copying Bugs. I think that's very unlikely. But I just think that it captured that sense there was at the time of the kind of, I guess, computer hackers as being incredibly arrogant, as being kind of prima donnas, being very rich, as being powerful, being high status. So yeah, I'd have to kind of go back and freeze frame to find the scene that I'm thinking of, but I'm sure there was an echo of it.
It certainly had a look. I can't say Doomwatch, Winter Angel, but it definitely had a look that was maybe even something from Bugs previously. They just recycled a set. I'm not sure. But back to this Alec killing the guy, and I mentioned those two previous ones on purpose because I think at the time we discussed both those episodes, I pointed out that I thought they were atypical for the way television typically works, in that, yes, they were fighting for their lives, but in both instances, I felt like they intentionally applied the, I'm going to fling you over the edge now. It's a life and death struggle, but they did actively force the person over the edge. You know, arguably they had no choice, but they took the act. And I said that, you know, typically what happens is they stage those things in such a way that the person manages to fall over themselves so that it absolves a little bit of the blame from the killing from the person, which is exactly what they did in Alex's case. I thought for a minute she was going to pick the guy up and fling him over, and it turns out she didn't have to. He did it to himself. So, you know.
Well, sort of. I mean,
He attacked her. She did some high karate on him, and he flung over to the.
Yeah, she obviously wasn't trying to fling him off the edge, but.
But if they'd been struggling and then she pushed him over, that would be what Ed and Beckett have done in the past. But this was.
Yeah, well, I mean, the parallel that I was thinking of was when Roz fired a gun at Kitty McCabe's car, which then turned out to blow her up and kill her. And so even though she hadn't intended that the shot would be quite that fatal, there was intentionality about it. Whereas I think in this case, it was pretty clear that to Alex, there was a threat to her own life. And also that their goal was actually to capture Flood, and that killing him was an inconvenience to them. So that was very much not the goal that they were aiming for.
I thought there was a particularly well thought out plan. They send Alex in as the maid. They get her to push the cart into the room. He gets his back to the door, and then Beckett and Roz walk up and stand behind him. And instead of doing anything, they get as close as they possibly can and said, "So who's Athena?" And he beats them up. Well, fair enough. That was absolutely incompetent of you, Beckett. I was like, wow, okay.
You can criticize that, but boy, it was worth it because that slow motion run down the corridor afterwards was so funny.
Well, I think I was probably still ranting about how did you think that was going to work, Beckett? How did you think that was going to work? You didn't even close the door behind you, so he couldn't just run out. But yeah, should say the bunker did not look to be a particularly practical nuclear bunker. Lots of walkways, no place for people to sleep. Yeah, you don't need. I don't think you need huge ceilings. I think you need floor space for people, right? I mean, maybe government bunkers in the UK are just for, 100 members of parliament and their families and their servants and perhaps their pets. And so they're not really trying to pack them in particularly, but it did seem
okay. Yeah.
And the art, she could not possibly have hoped to get any of that art out in that helicopter.
No, unless it doesn't seem very practical.
Yeah. We're going to lift all this stuff up. Don't worry. We got an elevator that'll get us up to a little helicopter, which, after I've jettisoned you three off, we'll have room for a little bit more. But that wasn't a cargo helicopter, and it was. And A-Team fashion, it all survived. They did say that at the end. They said all of the artwork survived. It's like, how? How did it survive that helicopter crash? Does that mean Sasha survived the crash too? Because, anyway, Beckett, Roz, Ed, Alex... Jan needs to have a talk with these people about inappropriate workplace fraternization.
Fraternization.
It's decongestants, antihistamines, painkillers, tea. Forgot to mention tea. I had a cup of tea. It's gone there. But yeah.
I will have to say that, and this is maybe due to having had expectations set rather low from previous episodes, but I had no problem with any of this because, although there were scenes where it kind of, yes, okay, it's people behaving a bit still like lovesick teenagers, it's not like it gets in the way, and actually it's not like it changes, in other respects they were much more the kind of the same old characters that they used to be. I certainly thought, for example, that Roz is back on form. I don't know if there's a kind of deliberate sense that, Channing having gone, and she says, well, yeah, Channing's history or whatever, that she's now she's not under his thumb anymore. She doesn't feel guilty about enjoying her work and all the things that he went on and on about, or whether that is just incidental about who happens to be writing this week. But either way, it felt much more like the kind of same old Roz of the earlier episodes. And even though Beckett had his moments or whatever, he wasn't kind of mooning around all the time, right?
Not a lot, no. No, he doesn't have the moon anymore. Channing's gone. But, yeah. Well, gone, gone forever. Gone, out of the picture. Never to be a problem again. Apart from the, this is the dumbest possible time for you to confess your feelings to Roz over the microphone and your glasses while you're on an undercover and dangerous assignment. But of course, it gives us the opportunity for there to be that, did she hear what I say? Didn't she hear what I say? Aspect to this, which of course we know she absolutely heard what he had to say, or at least the important part about what he had to say. What I thought was odd was at the end. And so she's obviously, I don't know, coaxing him maybe, or trying to see what he'll do in the hospital. And it looks like maybe he's going to say something. Maybe he's building up the courage to say something. Or he's going to say something stupid like, maybe you should go to America with Channing, like he did the last time he did this nonsense. But it gets right on that moment, and then Ed and Alex come in. Okay. Oh, are we interrupting something? And Roz says something like it can wait, or it, you know, whatever, right? She's just giving them the clue that says, now come on in, it's fine. But Beckett's face in that moment, and you know, I'm not going to say much about Jesse Birdsall's acting. You didn't see the air quotes there, acting. But he looks at that like she just kicked his puppy. Oh, you think this isn't important? Well, how would she know what it is? If you haven't told her and you don't think she knows, then you would not think that she's saying what you have to say isn't important. You would not react the way he did. But it looks more like he thinks Roz just said Beckett's feelings are irrelevant. And it looked like, which sadly means that for the next episode, we're not going to resolve this problem. Now he's going to be back in sulky mode. Pretty sure that's where we're going with this.
I don't think,
and there's no way he's going to tell her in episode 9. No way.
I don't think that's the reason for him reacting that way. I think the reason for him reacting that way is because he was about to tell her, and then she takes away the moment from him. He knows what he was going to say, and he was kind of, he spent some seconds psyching himself up to it. And then, the moment's gone.
Then he's the one that should have said, could you just give us a minute? Because how would Roz know? Actually, could you just give us a minute? And then they would step out, and he could finish what he was going to say, and then Roz would run out in a fit of anger, and they'd be like, what's going on here? Or whatever is going to happen.
No, I think it's pretty clear that Roz wants him to say it. She wants to give him the chance to say it. So she is interested. But obviously, we need, by the end of the season, to have somehow got to a point where this is not resolved. They can't resolve it. It's one of those things. It'll screw everything up if they let it happen. So they have to find some other problem for this particular course of true love to not run smooth.
My guess is that close to the end of episode 10, Beckett's going to screw up the courage to do it again, and Channing will burst through the door. Roz, I love you, and I can't live without you. And I'm fine with you being a danger junkie. Just be with me. And then Beckett will just kind of scuff his feet on the floor again, and then stomp off. That's my prediction.
Yeah, I don't think she's going to end up with Channing either, I have to say, but we'll see.
Well, I don't know that she will, but, you know, as a cliffhanger, maybe, because there's nothing really else that they've built up this season. Channing is the only thing they have built up this entire season. Oh, if you don't want to count the love affairs between the main characters, so which that Channing is tied into that. So, you know, it's not like the final confrontation with Jean Daniel, and it definitely doesn't feel like we're building to anything except some sort of romantic, and the next two are not two-parters, as I understand it. So it's not like we're running into a finale yet. I don't know that I have anything.
Speaking of Jean Daniel, one of the things that I was struck by in this episode was the, well, it comes back to this thing about the world of bugs and the way in which it's not quite our world. And when we had the Jean Daniel season, one of the kind of very peculiar things about that was the way in which there was that private prison and the kind of governance around that.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't get to see any of the kind of detail about the prisons in this episode. We got to see, I think was credited as the governor and assistant governor, having a conversation once one of the prisoners, Flood, I think it was released. But what we do get is a really quite curiously un-British, certainly un-British prison service aesthetic around, because the kind of key portrayal in this episode is the exteriors, because we're seeing the prisoners being released and being picked up by this limousine. And they're called things like Oak Ridge and Kingstoke and West Down, and the lettering. I mean, I thought it might, because the first of these is pre-credits, and I thought it might not even be supposed to be set in the UK, just going by the kind of aesthetic that we get from it. But it is. It's another kind of peculiarity of the Bugs UK, right down to the car registration, which is 008771. It's entirely numerical, which, I mean, I don't even know if you can have a private registration that is entirely numerical, though why you would have those particular numbers, I don't know. But, you know, the normal format for registration is a particular combination of letters and numbers. It has changed slightly since the 1990s, but it's still not like that registration was in any way a recognisably UK plate. So I don't know. It still strikes me as just kind of really weird the way it's an alternative London or an alternative UK.
No,
there are three separate prisons as well. So they didn't need to do that, but they did.
When I saw those prisons, the exteriors, and I saw those names of the prisons, two things occurred to me. One, these are not private prisons. These are British government prisons. And two, aren't the British quirky? This is exactly what I would expect. I mean, of course, I'm used to...
Oh, right.
I'm used to seeing things like Mind of Evil, your prisons are in old castles and stuff. I mean, it just feels like the way the British would do things.
Well, it's not the prison building that looks odd to me. It's the signage. It's actually...
Well, I don't know the fonts, but the sign looked...
The names and the lettering.
See, those names felt perfect to me.
That is really interesting, because it suggests that they were not only aiming for an international market, which I think we do know about this show, they had that intention. It's why it's got the kind of ad breaks, even though it was on the BBC. But they not only were aiming at that, they had what sounds like their finger on the pulse in terms of selling a version of British that's more British than British.
Isn't that what the Avengers was?
Yes, it is. I mean, we're back to the Brian Clemens connection, I think. But I guess my other question then, from what you've just said, because two things immediately popped into my head. My other question is, what was it about it that made you think these are government and not private prisons?
It's a good question. Did they not say H.M. Larkspur or whatever it was?
I don't think they can have done, because I'm not sure I would have had any doubts then if it said HM or HMP, whether it actually was set in the UK. And I was still pondering about that. So interesting.
I don't know. You know, well, part of it is to do with the style of sign. It's so dull and lifeless. Now, if that had been a private prison, I would have expected something a little fancier.
But it's not a dull. It is a rather
corporate branding. You know, maybe on a big... Yeah. Cement block with raised letters and stuff. You know, like you'd have it at corporate headquarters, not just the sign you erected on the the grounds.
So I've just checked whether it says HMP, and indeed it does not. The sign says Department of Prisons, and there is next to it a shield that I took to be something like the kind of NYPD badge. It looks a little bit like that. But actually, on closer examination, it's a piece of heraldry. It has a crown above it. So that could well have made you think, that's British. But I was much more struck by the kind of the odd, rather futuristic font in which they've put the name of the prison, which is Kingscote, and the fact that underneath it has a number, 25035, maximum security prison. That doesn't look at all British to me.
Well, I admit I have never actually walked past a British prison before.
I used to live.
Or ridden by it.
Ridden a few yards away from one.
Ridden by one in a ridiculously German car instead of a Rolls or something. It's a little disappointing.
I'll tell you something, though. I used to live very close to a prison, and I can't remember what the signage looks like because you didn't really notice the signage. But it did look like a castle, so fair enough. You were on point with that.
Any prison I've seen in the United States looks like a big, because I live in Arizona, we have big flat and no castles. So it's a big area that's devoid of all plants and has at least two layers of 20-foot tall chain link fence with barbed wire at the top and a barrier in between, and then a bunch of billet houses in the middle of it. It looks nothing like an American prison, but it definitely is that quirky. I could see John Steed going to visit somebody that he had captured in that prison and being very civil to him, because I don't know, they used to be old friends or something before it went bad, and they still stay in touch. If it had a motto or a slogan, then I would have thought it was corporate or mission statement.
Yeah. Raising maximum
more
security
prison than prison
is a statement. Well, it is a statement, but I don't think it's a motto.
I don't have anything else.
I think I'm pretty much all out.
Next time it is Identity Crisis, Episode 9, as we go barreling into the conclusion of Series 3 of Bugs. So I'm counting on it ramping up the excitement here. Simon, thank you for joining me.
Pleasure, as always.
And listeners, I hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
You've been listening to Fusion Patrol. Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, we hope you'll consider supporting us at buymeacoffee.com/fusionpatrol or patreon.com/fusionpatrol. For our monthly Patreon subscribers, we're currently running a special series on Babylon 5. Come join the conversation and find other content at fusionpatrol.com. And we're back on social media, where you can also follow us on Mastodon and the Fediverse. Our address is @podcast@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amberwolf. This has been a Lone Locust production. On the next episode of Fusion Patrol, we look at two more episodes of Neo Ultra Q. In The Tokyo Protocol, we ponder the very pointed commentary about the hubris of mankind in the face of climate change and ask, did they manage to stick the landing on this story? And in Falmagon and Michiru, we comment on the shallowness of youth and what happens when Neo Ultra Q tries telling a story with an actual ending. Come join the conversation.